a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Hopefully you had a good weekend. It was a good mix of productive and unproductive for me this weekend. We have a couple of new hens and a new rooster because we had a predator attack last week on the farm. I'm not happy about that. So we've got some new girls and a new rooster, Big Red, Rhode Island Red, running around. Well, actually not running around yet. We have kept them confined to the coop for a couple of days just so that they know where they have to go. And then this afternoon, they will be out for some supervised yard time. I am not quite ready to let them just go wandering around, so I will be out with my rifle this afternoon just in case any coyotes or fox decide to show up and try to take away the new additions to the farm. Anyway, hopefully you had a good weekend as well. We got a lot going on this week. Hunter Biden's trial begins in Delaware. Jury selection is underway this morning. The Supreme Court did not take any action once again with those Illinois Gun and Magazine ban cases. So I think it's pretty clear they're holding on to those cases until an opinion comes out later this term. Now, I've heard a lot of folks say that maybe it's the Rahimi opinion. I've suggested that perhaps it's Garland versus Cargill, the bump stock ban, that may implicate these Illinois Gun and Magazine ban cases. You know, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals stayed an injunction that had been granted by a U.S. District Court judge. Their logic, the Seventh Circuit's logic, was that AR-15s are not protected by the Second Amendment because they are like machine guns. So here you have a case in Garland versus Cargill where the government says attaching a non-mechanical bump stock to a semi-automatic firearm turns it into a machine gun. Seems to be like maybe, just maybe, the court is going to use that case to say, no, semi-automatic firearms are not machine guns. Whether you attach a non-mechanical bump stock or if you don't attach a non-mechanical bump stock, you should not be treating semi-automatic firearms as if they're machine guns. Now, maybe this is just wishful thinking on my part, but it seems like the court could take that step in Garland versus Cargill and then remand the Illinois cases back to the Seventh Circuit for further review in light of their findings. Fingers crossed that's going to be what happens here. I don't think at this point we're going to see certiorari granted to those cases. That's just my opinion. This has been held in conference now for 3 weeks. So if they're going to take the case, I think they would have. If they're going to just turn these cases away, I think that they would have. So my guess is that they are keeping a hold of these cases because one of their decisions this term will implicate the Seventh Circuit's decision, will have implications for the Seventh Circuit's decision. And Garland versus Cargill, rather, is at least as good a vehicle, if not a better vehicle for that than the Rahimi case. So we'll keep our eyes on what's going on at the Supreme Court. We're also watching what happened in New Hampshire this session. This is really interesting. So New Hampshire lawmakers introduced a bill. It's basically a fixed NICS bill. It's a records reporting bill. New Hampshire is one of a handful of states, maybe even less than a handful of states, that do not report to the National Instant Check System records from those who have been involuntarily committed. And in New Hampshire earlier this year, you had a individual who was at one point a patient of the state mental hospital who had been involuntarily committed, returned to the hospital with a firearm. We don't know how he got the gun yet. Police haven't said. Shot and killed a police officer, law enforcement officer who was stationed there. Nobody else, thankfully, was injured, but this has prompted some discussions in New Hampshire about, okay, what to do. Obviously, gun control advocates calling for gun bans, magazine restrictions, waiting periods, you name it, they're calling for it. But the sort of, you know, bipartisan compromise that was reached was a bill that would have reported these involuntary commitments to the NICS system so that individuals who were prohibited from possessing a firearm because of a mental illness would not be able to pass a background check in New Hampshire. The bill passed the House, died in the Senate. It was then revived and died in the Senate a second time. One of the groups that was in favor of this bill, National Shooting Sports Foundation, most of the state-level gun groups in New Hampshire, including the New Hampshire Firearms Coalition, opposed to this bill. Jake McGuigan with the National Shooting Sports Foundation joins me on today's program to provide the NSSF's perspective on this bill and why they think it should have passed and gone to Governor Sununu for his signature. Take a look and a listen. Jake, thanks so much for coming to the program, sir. It's good to see you again.
Cam, thank you for having me. I appreciate it every time I come on.
Absolutely. I don't know if you or Larry lost the arm wrestling match to come on the show today, but I'm glad you're here today. And I want to talk about what happened in New Hampshire, because this is interesting to me. And there's a lot of inside baseball stuff, right? So you had this bill. I think this is already the law in, 46, 47 other states?
You're correct with that. 47 other states. So three states that do not have what we call fixed nix legislation would be Wyoming, Montana, and obviously New Hampshire.
Okay. And when you talk about fixed nix legislation, what exactly are you talking about here?
So this is an initiative that the industry took on probably around 10 years ago now. What it essentially means is to make sure that the appropriate records are in the NICS background check system. And what that is there are some states that were not sending records for those who have been involuntarily committed. They've gone through the court process, they've gone through judicial proceedings, and they've essentially have been involuntarily committed because of mental health issues. What happens is that is a federal prohibitor. Right now, that is federal law, that if you are involuntarily committed, you should not have access and should not be allowed or prohibited from owning and purchasing a firearm. What happens is many states in the past were not sending these records to the NICS system. So the thing for our issue or for our industry, obviously our retailers depend on the background check system to make sure that when they transfer a firearm, they can be confident that the person receiving that firearm is not prohibited. So when states weren't sending these records off, there were situations like in New Hampshire where individuals are gaining access to firearms that probably should not have those because of their background.
Okay. One of the other arguments that I've heard raised in favor of the Fixed NICS Act is that, before Democrats start imposing universal background checks, things of that nature, fix the broken system, right? That's where the emphasis should be rather than expanding the universe of who has to go through a background check.
And that's 100% correct, right? If you have bad data in or lack of data in the system, you can expand it all you want, but you're not going to actually catch those people that are prohibited from owning a firearm. Obviously, the last thing the industry wants or retailers want is for a prohibited individual to gain access to a firearm. If you're not sending in those records, if you're not sharing the appropriate records with the federal system, that's what's happening. So before you even think about doing all the other stuff on the expansion, let's make sure that the appropriate records are in that system.
Okay, so in New Hampshire, this bill's introduced bipartisan basis. You got a Republican sponsor, you got a Democrat sponsor. It clears the Republican-controlled House, but then it hits a roadblock in the state Senate. It's voted down. Then lawmakers revived the bill, brought it back a second time around. It was voted down again in the state Senate. And there were, some objections to this. And I'm going to have to quote here. This is from Gannett. Senator Sharon Carson, a Londonderry Republican, criticized the bill's sponsors for not collaborating with gun rights groups in drafting the bill, saying it's important that their voices are heard, but they're never included in this process. So please, if you're going to bring things forward, include people who actually own guns and get their opinion. There were some concerns that this would not only allow for individuals who'd been involuntarily committed to be prohibited from possessing a firearm, but could in fact lead to firearms confiscation and even the confiscation of firearms that are owned by other people living in the house. So let's say, your brother or your son was involuntarily committed. That gets reported, then all of a sudden you are having your guns taken from you because otherwise that prohibited person is going to have access to that firearm. Can you talk about those objections? And are those reasonable objections in your opinion?
I think the in-state gun groups that were opposed to the legislation used that as a reason to defeat the bill or to push for the defeat of the legislation. I think there probably could have been ways to amend that to make that so it would not impact other family members. But reading that legislation, I mean, the one section that they have pulled out and made it a essentially, quote unquote, a red flag bill or a confiscation bill, again, if you have been involuntarily committed, Is there somebody that says you should be allowed to possess firearms if you've gone through the judicial process and you've been involuntarily committed or pled guilty by way of insanity for a crime? Should that person have a firearm? And if that's where what they've kind of staked their claim on, that is a confiscation bill, that is a little bit scary. The National Shooting Sports Foundation is a trade association for the firearms industry. In the past years, we have dealt with this fixed NICS legislation in New Hampshire. We have been called shills for the Bloomberg organization, right? Because we supported this bill. Again, the industry wants to make sure that those people who receive firearms and purchase firearms are lawful owners of those firearms. And if there was an issue with this and made it into a confiscation bill, you know, there probably could have been ways that could have been fixed if it impacted family members. But the fact that, you know, they're basically pointing to the fact that it is a red flag bill and taking away firearms from people who have been involuntarily committed. I can continue to say that. You've pled guilty by way of insanity, you've been involuntarily committed through a court process. This isn't just going on knocking on doors and taking firearms.
All right. You mentioned red flag. Was there a red flag component to that? Because obviously that's very different. Right. Then somebody who's been adjudicated, somebody who has been found to be mentally defective. Red flag laws don't have any of those provisions. Right. This is a judge says, well, you know, 51% chance you're dangerous. So, yeah, you can't own a gun for a while. Was there an actual red flag component to this bill?
I do not believe through my reading of the legislation that there was a red flag component. I think it was used to make it a confiscation bill and make it easier for Senate Republicans in New Hampshire to vote it down or vote against it because of it.
Jake, I mean, how much of this you think is just gun owners and Second Amendment groups saying enough is enough? We're not going to help you out in any way, shape or form, because if we give an inch, you take a mile. So even if on paper this, you know, doesn't appear to do anything other than reporting, federally prohibited people, we're not even going to take that step because we don't know where this leads. And we know what the Democrats want. We know they don't want to stop here.
And I agree completely. Listen, I oversee lobbying, the state lobbying for NSSF across all 50 states, and I have my focus in the Northeast. So you can imagine the states that I'm dealing with from basically Connecticut northward, including Massachusetts and Rhode Island. So I agree completely with that assessment that, you know, let's say we've seen situations where they pass a magazine ban or a restriction on, you know, modern sporting rifles. And, you know, the next day they pass the bill, but then the day after they say, yeah, but what about all those guns that people own? We need to get those back. So you are correct. You give an inch, they're going to take a mile, and they'll never be happy with that. The only issue here is that it is already a federal prohibitor. There's 47 other states that do that. And mind you, we've passed fixed NICS legislation in states like Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Alaska, Oklahoma. I mean, pretty strong Second Amendment states if you look at that. So again, we want to make sure that those people who basically, this was based upon a tragedy that could have been avoided in New Hampshire, right?
We don't know how that guy got his gun though yet, do we?
Not really, but he did. He could have been in the system. I mean, we've seen it, time and time again, where there are situations where these people should have been in the system, should not have been able to gain access to a firearm. But you're right, if he did not purchase them at a retailer, then that would be a different, obviously, situation.
Have you or anybody else with the NSSF spoken to any of the state level gun groups in New Hampshire who oppose this bill?
We have in the past. We have worked with national groups on this as well, because the concern is that there needs to be a restoration of rights in the bill. Obviously, we do not support any bills that do not have a restoration of rights, a process in order for those people to gain access to their firearms back if they go through, with treatment or other issues, in the future. So obviously, restoration of rights is key for any of these bills and for any of us to support that. We have tried to work with some in-state gun groups, but again, like you said, their mindset is, we're not giving an inch. We don't think that this is correct. We think that this process and sharing anything with the federal government is not the way to go. And, that's their opinion, and they can, believe that. But I think at the end of the day, there will be finger pointing if there is another tragedy where that could have been avoided because of a prohibited person having a firearm.
Well, and I suspect that you're right. But I think this is also a sign, you know, you talk about Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma. I don't know when fixnicks pass in those states, but I think within the past, you know, year or two, and certainly this year, as we get closer to the presidential election, there really is a mindset. And I think it's understandable, even if a bill is as, you know, supposedly as innocuous as this one, of we're not going to lift a finger to help the other side out. And if you've got advocates from Moms Demand Action or any gun control groups that are supporting the bill, we're going to oppose it.
You are correct. It becomes very difficult in those situations to do that. But as you know, a lot of our groups, a lot of our strong Second Amendment supporters, what is our response in a lot of instances? Enforce the current laws you have in the books. Correct? Right? So this is a current law, right? But it is one that is not being abided by New Hampshire and a few other states in sharing those records. That's my concern with that. I understand where you're coming from and I understand where others are coming from, but we're always saying, hey, enforce the current laws, criminals in possession of firearms, mandatory sentences. We all agree with that 100%. And this is another situation. If you've been involuntarily committed, I'm not entirely sure you should have access to firearms.
Was there a restoration of rights component to this bill?
Yes,
there was. Okay. But one of the other problems, I think you'll acknowledge this, Jake, is that as you talk about, this is a federal prohibitor, right? So it is really, really difficult to federally get your rights restored, whether it's based on a felony conviction or an adjudication of mental illness, right? That you can have states that I think provide that avenue. But this is maybe a different subject altogether, but there is still that roadblock at the federal level, which again might make, you know, again, Second Amendment advocates in states like New Hampshire reluctant to move forward with this. Even if there's that restoration of rights at the state level, is there going to be follow through at the federal level? Right.
Correct. I mean, how many people that, you know, that, you know, will purchase a firearm and get a delay and then they try to figure out exactly what that delay is. Why am I getting delayed? I just bought a gun 2 months ago and it was not an issue and now I'm delayed or vice versa. So I agree with that sentiment completely. Again, though, if the states and a lot of the states that have passed fixnicks legislation continue to send those records in, if somebody does have a restoration of rights, it's not included in another data set of records that gets sent to NICS. So you would hope in that situation, again, we become dependent on, you know, bureaucracy and government, which we all know that that doesn't end up working out very well in the long run. But you are correct that, you know, there are concerns with making sure that you can kind of get that restoration back. But if the state is doing their appropriate, you know, appropriate role, the judicial system, you would hope that that would not be a problem.
You would hope. But again, I think among gun owners and certainly among conservatives, you know, now you look at the Trump verdict last week and there are a lot of folks who say, I don't trust the criminal justice system, to be fair with me, particularly as a gun owner. I don't trust the criminal justice system, to be fair with me. I don't trust the federal government, to be fair with me. And I think that those are a couple of the roadblocks that y'all are dealing with, you know, in trying to pass this legislation in New Hampshire and Montana and Wyoming, I guess the other states. These are also three states, by the way, that, you know, are among the strongest pro Second Amendment states in the nation. And so I think that there is that skepticism about, well, again, why do we want to do anything that a gun control advocate might support, even if the industry supports it? I don't know that it's going to happen. I'd love to see NSSF sit down with some of the state level groups and try to figure out, OK, where is this common ground? Is there some common ground to be found? Can we write this bill in a way that satisfies, the most ardent Second Amendment supporter? I see both positions pretty clearly. But I think that politics ultimately, I think politics is what's to blame for this bill not passing, not necessarily the text of the bill itself. Correct. I think it is the atmosphere surrounding gun control and Second Amendment legislation in this country.
And there were states where we did that. We did work very closely with leadership to make sure that it was a very, you know, very strict bill, very, very, very focused bill with obviously the involuntary commitments, a very strong restoration of rights. So that would be something that we'd be more than happy to work in the future on, something like that, so that it is not a confiscation bill. It is not a bill that impacts, you know, family members that could be associated with, you know, an individual. So, and we had done that in many states where, you know, okay, we're not necessarily agreeing with this or with that. So, you know, it's a give or take. You know, we've been dealing with this in New Hampshire for many, many years, back and forth. And like I said, you know, we've been told we're shrill for the for the Bloomberg organization. So and that's, we get put in a very difficult spot, because you have those who don't want to share any records, right? Then you have those within the mental health community that think you're going to stigmatize mental health. So then basically everyone's yelling at us for this bill on both sides of the aisle. Like, wow, we've never been in this position before.
Well, yeah, so it's interesting because, I mean, again, you talk about the gun owner groups, right? And then you talk about the mental health groups, and NSSF is an industry group.
Correct.
You know, as Larry Keene has mentioned several times, you know, this is not, National Shooting Sports Foundation is not purely a Second Amendment advocacy organization. It is not an organization for gun owners. It is the organization, the trade group that represents the firearms industry. Mm-hmm. And so your perspective is not always going to align with that of gun owners. It's not always going to align with that of the mental health community. But I am a big believer in, you know, more dialogue, more discussion, less pointing fingers, less name calling. If there is some common ground to be found, and I suspect that there is, maybe after the election, when passions cool down, maybe not the case this election. But you know, it depending on the results of the election, there may be an atmosphere that allows for those discussions to take place. But I you know, again, I do see the legitimate concern on the part of gun owners. I do see the industry's perspective on this. Again, it is, you know, and the other aspect of this, I mean, we talk about the politics. So, you know, let's say that going forward, somebody who has been adjudicated as mentally defective, they are federally prohibited, but that record has not been reported. Let's say that they do acquire a gun legally. Mm-hmm. They go on to commit another crime. You're going to hear, you know, cries for a lot more than a fix Nix bill, right, you know, come out of New Hampshire. And New Hampshire, God bless it, it's the live free or die state. It's got the biggest state legislature in the country. I can't remember, yes, 400, 500 people in the state house and Senate.
Yep.
Republicans, it is not the lock that Republicans have had on that state for decades. Democrats are making gains there. Mm-hmm. And New Hampshire at this point is kind of an outlier, right? I mean, we're seeing gun control bills pass in Maine, seeing Governor Phil Scott allowing gun control bills to take effect without vetoing them or signing them. Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. I mean, God bless. We already know what those states are like. You know, is there an argument to be made that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that, you know, pass this bill now, and that way, if God forbid something happens in the future, this is an argument that's taken off the table.
I think you're right with how you even laid it out leading up to that question. Our retailers are concerned about transferring that firearm if they cannot depend on the data that's in the system. So like you said, if there was a, God forbid, another tragedy where it was acquired from the retailer, you know, and the background check was done, what's the first thing that's going to happen to that retailer? All the media is going to be outside asking him, why'd you transfer that gun, or how'd you transfer that gun? And he said, I did a background check. I have the 4473. I've done everything correct. But he's... really, no pun intended, there will be a target on his back as a retailer. We know what happens with tracing data and various other issues that impact our retailers across the country. So I think, again, as you mentioned, we might have, we agree 95% of the time, you know, on firearms issues, but this is one situation where our industry and our retailers want to be confident that the background checks that they are conducting are true and have the correct data in there. That's essentially all we're trying to help our retailers be confident in that. When they don't, and when they see this and something goes wrong, you know, they're on the hook for it. And yeah, that's I think, you know, the ounce of prevention and all that, I think it's to prevent prohibited people from gaining access to firearms at the retail level.
Of course, those gun stores get blamed no matter what state, right? Correct. We know that, too. You know, in California, with all of the gun control laws, you still have questions. New York, same thing. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, Jake, I do appreciate your perspective, and I hope that we can continue the conversation again. I would encourage NSSF to reach out to these state level groups and hopefully come to some sort of agreement. Maybe again after the election, the politics will be better. But I appreciate you joining us on the program today, sir.
Thank you, Kim. Have a great afternoon.
Appreciate it. Yeah, man. You too.
Thank you.
My thanks to Jake for joining me on the program. And as I said, I hope that NSSF and these groups can sit down and maybe come to some sort of agreement here. I do see both perspectives, but I also really do believe that we need to work on a restoration of rights process. We were talking about this already when it comes to, again, those convicted of a felony offense, right? I brought up Rahimi, the case dealing with an individual who was barred from possessing a firearm because of a domestic violence restraining order. The Supreme Court has taken a look at that case. They've held on to a half dozen other prohibited persons cases, and it's believed that the court in Rahimi is going to sort of flesh out, okay, who can be denied their right to keep and bear arms? And is a simple felony conviction enough? Is a conviction of a crime punishable by more than a year in prison enough? Is a temporary restraining order enough? Is there a national tradition to bar somebody from possessing a firearm? Does there need to be some sort of finding of dangerousness? Which, again, would implicate, I think, those who've been adjudicated mentally defective as well. Unless there is a finding of dangerousness, then why should somebody who's been involuntarily committed at some point in the past be forevermore denied a right to keep and bear arms? So maybe that this bill is a victim of timing and circumstance, not only with the sort of line in the sand that's been drawn on the part of Second Amendment groups, saying we're not going to lift a finger to help any gun control organization do anything that they want to do. But also, again, now that we are sort of talking about who gets to exercise their right to keep and bear arms, either after a criminal conviction, maybe we should expand that conversation to include who gets to exercise their right to keep and bear arms after an adjudication of mental illness as well. And in that case, again, there really does need to be not just a theoretical path to rights restoration. There needs to be a substantive path that individuals can follow to regain those rights that they've once lost. All right, we're going to continue talking about this issue in the days and weeks ahead. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about this for just one second. At the very heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred, free speech. It's the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future are being silenced or overshadowed in mainstream narratives, leaving many feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. This is where Wealth Protection Research steps in, armed with a mission that's never been more critical. Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They're defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. Now, Wealth Protection Research tirelessly seeks out financial experts, the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report. This free report highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas the mainstream media won't touch. Listeners can get it absolutely free. Just text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told, to hear the ideas the establishment doesn't think you can handle, and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. All right, now let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Today's recidivist report got a tip from Matt in Colorado. So thank you, Matt. Hope that you and your lovely bride, Marcia, are doing well. Here is the headline. Man accused of August drive-by shooting in Longmont sentenced to probation. That's right. Now, keep in mind, in Colorado this year, they passed all kinds of gun control bills. But Democrats were loath to do anything that would actually increase punishment or sentences for those convicted of even violent crimes, like child sex trafficking. Democrats at one point rejected a measure, an amendment to an existing bill requiring storage mandates. Republicans offered an amendment that would have increased the penalty for stealing a gun from a misdemeanor to a felony. Right now, it's not always a misdemeanor in Colorado. It's based on the value of the firearm. But this would have made it a blanket felony. You steal a gun, you've committed a felony crime. Democrats didn't want that. Even their ban on so-called assault weapons, which ultimately died in committee, originally did not have any jail time or prison time imposed if you were caught selling one of these illegal guns. It was a fine of $250,000. They amended that during the legislative process, and I think it was punishable by up to 30 days in jail. They did tack on At one point, they, you know, the most minor of jail times that they could put in. But Democrats do not. I mean, they want to put a lot of laws on the books in Colorado. And maybe lawful gun owners are the ones that they'd like to put behind bars, but they are not doing anything. In fact, they're taking the opposite step to try to keep violent offenders out of jail. Now, did that have an impact on what happened in Longmont? Maybe not the legislature, but I think you definitely have to talk about the DA. So in April of this year, 20-year-old Manuel Munoz Vaquera pleaded guilty to being an accessory to a crime as well as using a prohibited weapon. In exchange, two charges of attempted first-degree murder were dismissed, as well as two of the four sentence enhancers with their corresponding charges. Again, we don't want to do anything to enhance the sentence of somebody who used a gun in a drive-by shooting, right? Well, last Friday, Munoz Vaquera was sentenced to 3 years probation for accessory to a crime and prohibited use of a weapon firearm. Boulder District Judge D. Lindsay also ordered Munoz Vaquera to complete 30 days of work release, as well as 96 hours of community service. As part of the probation, he can have no contact with his co-defendant, Marcos Padilla, who is now serving a 9-year prison sentence for the shooting. Munoz Vaquera also sentenced to mandatory substance abuse monitoring in response to the DUI charges against him. I mean, come on now, really? During sentencing, Deputy District Attorney, this is from the Boulder Daily Camera, Deputy District Attorney Megan Tholen said that Munoz Vaquera had minimized the shooting, as well as the severity of his traffic offenses. She pointed out in an interview in which Munoz Vaquera was asked, who are the people hurt by your crime? To which he responded, nobody. She said, that's a concerning lack of empathy. This is a community. This is a trailer park. They don't have substantial funds to get up and move. So based on that, you might have thought that the prosecutor would ask for some prison time. No. Instead, she asked for 4 years of probation. The judge gave him 3. 4 years. That's getting tough on him. 4 years probation. Stating the pre-sentence investigation recommended a minimum of 3. Also asked for 90 days of work release, 96 hours of community service, as well as mandatory substance abuse monitoring. It was not at the discretion of probation. Tholen said he's going back into this community. Hope he chooses to give back to the local community in Longmont. Yeah, so too. But at this point, let's just, you know, see if we can get through probation, right? Daily Camera reports one of the victims said she and her family are scared that Munoz Vaquera will hurt them in the future. Through an interpreter, she said, I'm really concerned he's going to get out because nobody can guarantee to me that he's not going to want to hurt us more. We're really very afraid. Well, he is for sure getting out. I mean, that's happening. 30 days of work release. So, you know, that's about the only confinement that he's going to have. And, you know, if those folks are concerned that Mr. Munoz Vaquero is going to pose a threat to the public safety in the future, I think that they have reason to be afraid. But they can't look to the criminal justice system in Colorado for help. In that case, I would recommend perhaps it's time for those folks to exercise their Second Amendment rights to armed self-defense. Speaking of today's armed citizen story, from the U.S. Virgin Islands, you know, we're talking a lot about the Turks and Caicos Islands, which is a British protectorate. Gun possession absolutely banned in the Turks and Caicos Island, as well as ammunition. Right. In fact, a single round of ammunition brought illegally into the island could land you in prison for up to 12 years, absent exceptional circumstances, as several U.S. tourists have found. Judge in Turks and Caicos has declared that exceptional circumstances exist, and these tourists who accidentally brought ammo to the islands with them on vacation have been allowed to go home after paying substantial fines. I think one about $6,700, the other close to $10,000. Things are a little bit different in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Not too far away from the Turks and Caicos, but in the U.S. Virgin Islands, U.S. law still applies, and you do have the right to keep and bear arms. You have the right to act in self-defense. And authorities in St. Croix have ruled that the shooting of a man in the Sion Hill area last week was, in fact, an act of self-defense. It's a tragic story. This was a father who was forced to defend himself against his son. According to the Virgin Islands Police Department, the 911 call center got a report around 12:30 last Thursday afternoon that a man had shot his son in the abdomen. When detectives arrived on the scene, they were told that an older man was attacked by his son, identified as a 44-year-old James Knowles. Knowles apparently armed with a machete at the time. A witness told police, and this is the same witness who called in the 911 call apparently, Witness who reported the incident stopped the attack before Knowles returned and then advanced on his father with a reciprocating saw in his hand. So he really has a thing for bladed weapons, apparently. Father drew his firearm, fired three shots at his son, according to police. Knowles was taken to a local hospital for emergency surgery. He later died as a result of his injuries. And again, the father will not be facing any charges. I am sure that he is grieving. What an awful incident. But he was justified in using lethal force to protect himself against his son there in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Finally, today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A group of neighbors in Holden, Massachusetts, who saved their neighbor after his car blew up over the weekend. Yeah, apparently the man had stored a tank of acetylene gas in the trunk. There was a leak, and then it went kablooey. This was Saturday in Holden, Massachusetts. Neighbors had to rush to pull the man from underneath the car after the explosion. He was taken to a local hospital with serious injuries. Cindy Benoit, who's a neighbor, said it was just a major boom, and the house shook. The left driver's side tire, the rear one, completely over his lower leg. He's laying flat on his back with his hand out, and he was just saying, "Get the car off me." She added, he kept telling us, "Look for his wallet and phone." He was very calm, probably because he was in shock at that point, I would imagine. Benoit's daughter, Paige, says, "My dad saw the windshield fly into our front yard. Windshield wiper actually ended up by our front porch." Multiple first responders arrived after multiple 911 calls. State Fire Marshal's office says when they arrived, they observed a car that had sustained catastrophic damage, as well as an adult male who neighbors had already pulled from underneath the vehicle. Fire Marshal's office says that based on interviews and evidence at the scene, they've collectively determined that a man stored that acetylene tank overnight in the trunk of his vehicle, where it appears to have leaked. They said the exact ignition source remains unknown. Investigators believe that it was accidental. Investigators say the blast did not cause any significant fire damage, significant damage to the vehicle in question. Again, a catastrophic loss of the car, but thankfully not a loss of life because, again, of those neighbors who were able to respond so quickly to the blast, pulling the man from underneath the wreckage of his car. Serious injury sustained. I'm sure a long road to recovery ahead, but thankfully no loss of life this weekend because that man's neighbors were in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow. We'll have more on the Hunter Biden trial throughout the week at BearingArms.com, as well as the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. Colorado Governor Jared Polis signing another gun ban bill into law over the weekend, this one dealing with sensitive places. And now campus carry in Colorado. It's been on the books for 20 years. No more. We're talking about that on the website. If you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code GUNRIGHTS and you can save 50% on your membership. You'll get exclusive content, an ad-free experience, the ability to comment on stories and more. You'll also be helping us continue to do the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism we do at Bearing Arms. So thank you again for all of your support. See you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.